Welcome, everyone. It looks like we have the two attorneys joined us now as well, and so I'll have the marshal introduce the panel, please.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Jessen, Judge Cochran, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
And good morning again, everyone, and welcome to the Court of Appeals for December 3. This is the second of our five matters, second of two oral, I should say, and we have three non-oral matters we'll be considering today as well. Though we're all digital and appearing remotely, everything else pretty much is the same. You can see the clock in the corner box, and if at any time you can't see it, do let us know. If for some reason we lose, from a technological standpoint, hearing you, we've instructed the marshal to stop the clock, so obviously we can preserve the time once we get reconnected. We've had good luck today so far, but you just never know with technology. And we do ask that you remain muted when you're not on the mute button when you're not talking, and we'll do the same. And when you begin your arguments, if you would identify your full name for our record, we are recording these proceedings and they'll be available on the judicial branch's website within 24 hours. So we do preclude, prohibit anyone else from recording in any way this proceeding. And so unless there's any questions, if counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and begin. I'm sorry, first I should note before, I don't think I did identify the case number and name. It's A200872 in re the estate of Shirley Joy Pratt. And counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. John, or may it please the court, John Worley here on behalf of the appellant. And I'd like to mention that co-counsel is also with me in the office today. She's not on a separate Zoom camera, but Teresa Molinaro, who's also appellant's co-counsel, is with me here today. I'd like to point out, first of all, that this is a very limited scope appeal. The trial was about three issues. It was about whether to void a real estate deed about the decedent's homestead, whether to probate a will, and whether to replace a personal representative. And those were the three issues raised by the respondents in their pleadings in the probate court. And they prevailed on all three issues at trial. What we're appealing is something that the trial court granted in the matter of relief that was not raised in those pleadings and that was not tried below. The trial court ordered the personal representative to distribute the estate's assets in a manner contrary to the decedent's will. See, the decedent's will said that the estate will be distributed in four equal parts, one part for each child. But the trial court decided, even though the trial court found that the will was valid, he decided that the estate's assets should only be distributed in three equal parts, excluding my client. That's
Mr.
the one.
Mr. Worley, just to clarify, there was an issue of undue influence in the proceeding before the district court, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. There was undue influence alleged about the real estate deed. There was no undue influence alleged about the will, though. Everyone agreed that the will was valid and it should be distributed in four equal parts. In fact, it was the respondents who requested the probate of that will that distributed the assets in four equal parts, and we agreed with it, and the trial court agreed with it.
And you're not, just a couple more questions to make sure I'm clear on your argument. You're not challenging the finding of undue influence in this appeal?
Correct. We are not asking for review of that, Your Honor.
And you're not challenging any of the district court's other factual findings?
Correct. We are not challenging any factual findings.
So in light of that, isn't it fair to say that the district court's relief was designed to address the undue influence that was found by the district court?
Well, Your Honor, the relief that the trial court entered here to distribute the assets according to, you know, different than what the will suggested, appears that maybe it was aimed at remedying that, but we don't really know. I mean, there wasn't an explanation. And when it comes to this issue of, you know, was there damages from the undue influence? You know, there was two things that happened in 2016 and 17. One was that the homestead was transferred from the decedent to my client. And the other thing is that there were these joint bank accounts that the decedent removed herself from. Now, the district court remedied everything that it could remedy. It put the homestead back in the decedent's name, but if it found undue influence in the removal of the decedent's name from those bank accounts, all it would do was revert those accounts back to 2008, which my client was a joint owner on. So in either situation, my client would have been the sole owner of those accounts as soon as the decedent died, regardless of what happened in 2016 and 2017. So there were perhaps damages, but those were remedied regarding the homestead. There's no basis for damages regarding those joint accounts, because under Minnesota law, the last man standing in a joint account inherits those assets.
Well, let's discuss that for a minute, because I think the statute provides that you're referring to. When you say Minnesota law, are you referring to Minnesota statute 524.6-204?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And I think that statute provides that the sums remaining go to the surviving party or parties against the estate of the decedent, unless, and number one is, there's clear and convincing evidence of a different intention. And as I read the district court's order, I think the district court did find that in paragraph 86, when the district court found, this court finds that when Shirley transferred her St. Paul condo and her and cash assets to Deanne, it was her intention to preserve those assets for an ultimately equal distribution among her four children, with the intention that Deanne get a slightly greater amount based upon Deanne's care of Shirley. And also the district court found that the $121,000 in the account in paragraph 40, that was an asset of, that was Shirley's cash asset. The district court did not find that to be a joint asset. And based on your earlier statement, it's my understanding that you're not challenging that finding of fact or the finding of fact in paragraph 86. So I guess I would like you to address, given the findings of fact by the district court, that you're not challenging it, you know, whether your position still holds.
I do believe it does, Your Honor. I mean, when we think about this record, I think we need to recognize that this challenge about the joint ownership of the accounts was not raised in pleadings. My client had no notice that this issue was before the trial court. It wasn't before the trial court. It wasn't tried by consent, and it wasn't raised in the pleadings. My client would have submitted evidence to rebut this. We would have done discovery on it. We would have taken depositions on this issue, but it simply wasn't before the court. So when we look at the record evidence here, I'd say the record is incomplete at best on this issue, because she didn't have notice that it was being raised. And you see that in the record.
Well, wasn't there discussion though before the judge about whether that asset would have gone to Shirley as a joint asset or as a joint account? I believe in the transcript, I'd have to find the page reference, but I recall that there was some argument by both parties on that issue.
Yes, Your Honor, and this is in the appellant's addendum. If we're referring to the same part of the transcript, I included this part in our addendum. At addendum 38 to 43, in that part of the addendum, the parties all agree that these were jointly owned assets, and the court clarified that. Both respondents and appellant, everyone agreed that since 2008, this was jointly owned. The court specifically said, so that means Deanne would have been able to spend every nickel of this, and she was the owner of that account. That was effectively stipulated to on the record, even though it wasn't before the court. I mean, it wasn't pled in their pleadings. It wasn't raised. And so my client didn't have any reason to rebut this with the record.
And thank you. Sorry.
Your Honor,
go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. There was another part of your question, and that goes to the findings that you pointed out. Finding 86, a district court finds that when Shirley transferred the St. Paul condo and cash assets to Deanne, she was doing so to preserve them. I think in the context that finding is about the removal of Shirley as a joint owner in 2016 and 17, which is the medical assistance planning. So to say that Shirley transferred those assets, what it's really saying is removed herself as a joint owner of that asset. And when we look at 524.6-204, the court needs to find by clear and convincing evidence a different intent. And I think in order to do that, we would need to look at 2008. And there was nothing in this trial that was about, other than that part of the transcript that we just looked at, there was nothing in the trial about 2008. The entire trial focused on 2016-17 and what happened then. So my client had no reason to believe that she needed to raise evidence about what happened in 2008 and what the decedent's intention was when she created that joint account in 2008. Thank you, Your Honor. I'll proceed here. When it comes to the following a decedent's will, we've got Minnesota law that says that the will needs to be followed. And so you've got assets in the estate now. You have this homestead in the estate, and the will says you've got to divide it in four equal parts. And the trial judge doesn't have the power to deviate from that. He found the will valid and doesn't have the power to then cross my client's name out of that will. Now, you and I just went over, we just went over this issue of the joint account, so I won't belabor that, but I will just say, if that issue was going to decide this, if my client's property rights were going to be taken from her in those joint accounts, or to remedy that in this estate, she needed notice. They needed to raise it in a pleading, and they didn't. If they want to do that, they could do that. They could open up a separate lawsuit in Ray bank accounts, et cetera, or raise that in a pleading and take us through the process, and we can do that. But it wasn't raised, and my client didn't have notice of it. And lastly,
Worley, could I inquire about that? It seems the court in its findings, which I understand are not contested, though, in making its findings that there was an ongoing desire for equal distribution, but that she had received funds, was also referring and funds over and above what might have been funds to reimburse her for caring for her. Would not it have behooved your client at that stage to bring a motion for amended findings, perhaps making the same argument you're making now, that the court has raised issues by its findings and conclusions that were not pled?
Perhaps, Your Honor, that if I understand the question correctly, it's why wasn't this argument made for amended findings? Why is it being made on appeal?
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, the frank answer is that this issue wasn't before us at the time. And we just looked at this order and said, well, he's deviating from the terms of the will, and we don't understand why. I mean, all the questioning that we're getting today and all the context is only in my mind because it was raised by the respondent's brief. I mean, this issue about the joint accounts and the equalization, and a claim being satisfied, that wasn't in our mind. It was raised before us as a theory of recovery by the respondents for the first time in their brief. So yeah, I mean, if it would have been argued below at trial and this would have been out in the open, then perhaps we could have done it that way. But it was raised for us. I mean, it wasn't addressed in the appellant's brief at all because it wasn't raised for us.
And would you agree in any event that the court, because probate is includes a component of equity as noted in the statute itself and case law, that if a court makes a determination that a party has already received their 1/4 share, that out of equity, the court can adjust the will, adjust the payment, I should say, and that would still comply with the will provisions because she's already received her 1/4 share. And I understand your separate argument about the joint accounts, and that's part of why I raised the previous question.
Your Honor, thanks for the question. I think it's a really important one. It is addressed in our brief because when I did read the trial court's order, that's what I thought he was doing. And there's a doctrine in the law about that. It's called the doctrine of advancements, which allows a trial court to look at everything that's been given to someone prior to death and take it into consideration and do an equalization of the final distribution of assets. But the statutes, it's clear that doctrine only applies in intestate estates. And the reason it only applies in intestate estates is because the law presumes that when someone made a will, the case law, and this is the estate of Beyer, says that the law presumes that the testator has considered all of those advancements and bequests. In fact, it says the testator is conclusively presumed to have considered those things, not a rebuttable presumption. It's not like they can come raise arguments that can rebut the presumption of distribution in the estate. And keep in mind, these joint accounts were from 2008, and she made her will in 2014. So even though the will provides a conclusive presumption, the facts themselves even suggest that she would have been able to change this account and put it back into her estate so that it wasn't going to my client when she did her will in 2014 and she didn't.
Thank you.
Yeah. And one last point about the homestead. Minnesota law has a homestead exemption that provides very strong protection for claims. It says that if a child's going to inherit a homestead, it descends free of all claims. Now, if the respondents are correct that the trial court was satisfying a claim against my client, then the trial court violated that homestead exemption by attempting to remove her homestead exemption in order to satisfy this claim. Thank you. My time is up.
You're welcome. And you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And counsel for respondent, if you would identify yourself for our record, we'll reset the clock and you may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Frank Rondoni. I represent the respondents in the case, Mary Adlin and Richard Pratt. I would like to start out my comments by pointing out to the court that prevailing on these fact issues in a probate matter is by clear and convincing evidence, and that is a high burden. And none of the findings are being challenged here, and yet we are being asked to ignore pretty much what Deanne did and allow her to get a portion of the estate despite these activities. Initially, I want to talk a little bit about the doctrine of retainer. There is a statute in Minnesota that specifically gives the personal representative and the court the power to offset distributions to an heir against any debt that is owed by the heir. And in this case, it's relatively simple. It's 524-3903. There's just two prongs to the test. The first is Deanna a successor? She is by definition. And secondly, is there a debt to the estate? And the court found that she took both the cash of $121,000 and she took the condominium under false pretenses. Clearly, there was a debt that had to be paid back if you take something under false pretenses. The appellant here makes an issue of the fact that this was not raised at the trial level. The trial was about what assets that the appellant took belong back into the estate. The application of retainer and the sale of the homestead are normal probate processes in dealing with the assets. And the court looked at this and there was only one asset left at the end of the trial, and that was the homestead. So the court had all of the information that it needed to determine whether the homestead would be sold and where it would go. And that's exactly what the court did. It's important to note, and it's a little unclear in the appellant's materials, that the condominium was never the homestead of Deanne Pratt. And that is because the court found by clear and convincing evidence that the quitclaim deed was void. So at that point, it was never her homestead. She lived there for a while, but it was never her homestead. And
Mr. Rondoni, can you, with regard to your argument that the district court found that there was a debt. What findings would you point us to support your argument or your assertion that the district court actually found that she was indebted to the estate?
I would point the court to, among other findings, finding number 91 on page 17 and finding number 95 on page 18. The court does not use the words indebted in the findings. However, the court finds that she acquired these assets under false pretenses, and by any definition and application of law, that would be an obligation to return those assets. And in fact, that's what the court determined needed to be done, that the assets would be returned. So
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor, go ahead.
In this context then, how would you distinguish an advancement from a debt? In other words, why would this be a debt versus an advancement? The funds that she had used.
The concept of advancement, as I understand it, is in cases of intestacy. In this case, I don't think it was an advancement in layman's terms of a sort of early receipt of your inheritance. These are assets that she wrongfully took. And in the one case of the cash assets, she spent them all, essentially. So the distinction here between advancements and retainer would be that retainer would apply in a probate proceeding where there is a will, as opposed to advancements that would really apply to intestacy.
Assuming it is a debt, then can you address appellant's argument about the homestead law and the offset, or that the homestead is exempt from debts?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd be happy to do that. As I indicated, the Deanne was never, this was never her homestead. The will does not deal with the home separately. The will simply says whatever assets I have are going to be divided equally between my four children. 524-402 specifically applies to homesteads. The probate court deals with homesteads all the time. And in fact, this court, in the unpublished case that we refer to in Re Estate of Allard, said this: an interest in a homestead, remainder or otherwise, is clearly subject to the jurisdiction of the probate court. In fact, the personal representative has the power to sell the homestead. If you take a look at 524.3.715 sub 6 and sub 30 and sub 23, the personal representative has the power to do that. What happened here is that this condominium after her death was an asset of the estate and was going to be liquidated and distributed to the heirs pursuant to law. And that's what was done. In addition to the argument about retainer, it's also important to note that the will itself indicates that if there is an indebtedness to the estate or the decedent, it's offset. And that is Article 3.1 of the will itself. So in addition to the retainer argument under the statute and the law and common law that supports it, the will itself provides that, hey, if you have a debt, it's going to be offset against what you receive here. What the appellant is seeking to do is to ask this court to essentially rule, if you fraudulently acquire somebody's homestead and you have to give it back, you're still entitled to your share. And that is not the law here. And that would be a poor public policy as well. The asset comes back into the estate and was distributed precisely the way the will indicated and was offset by the debt that she had. Importantly, I think, the appellant here received her inheritance. She got it. She got her inheritance and more of that. And the court found that she simply spent it, is what has happened. In terms of the relief being sought here, I think it's important to note that the issue of these financial accounts were in fact litigated at trial. Not only were they litigated at trial, but the court found that they were litigated at trial and made findings that aren't being challenged here and would need to be challenged to support the argument appellant's making. And importantly, when we just looked at this, not only did we litigate the issue, but we came to a stipulation for the court at the end of the trial, so the court knew exactly what the party's positions were with regard to those assets. To indicate that those were not addressed at the court is simply not accurate, and the record speaks for itself. Importantly, when you file a petition for probate and you ask the court to probate a will, part of that process is to not only determine the assets, but to distribute them. At the time of the filing of the petition, we may not have known all of what had been going on with Deanne and her mother, but certainly by the time of trial, those issues were fully litigated and the court decided them in respondent's favor.
Mr. Rondoni, Mr. Worley referenced us the beginning and the transcript where the judge is asking about those joint accounts, and at least at that stage, confirming what the law would suggest is she's a joint owner. Can you refresh my memory in terms of the stipulation that you're referring to as to those same joint accounts?
Yes, Your Honor. I think if you take a look at the appendix of the appellant, and it starts at ADD 039, the appellant put the stipulation into the court record, and there is a discussion there that talks about specifically the appellant and the respondents stipulating that these accounts in 2016 had $121,000 in them, that the party stipulated that at that point at trial, there was zero left of those amounts, and that there had been, and the testimony at the trial was that as part of the estate planning process, when the condo was transferred, the decedent was removed from the account. At that point, it is clear from the court's findings that the reason that the decedent did that was the false promises made by Deanne that she was going to maintain those assets and distribute them to her siblings. In fact, what is really interesting in this case is that the attorney for the decedent testified and had correspondence after the decedent's death saying, yes, we're going to distribute these assets equally to everybody. And then Deanne just changed her mind and refused to do it. The attorney for the decedent was put in the unusually difficult position of having to try to explain this at trial. But the testimony was that, you know, but for this promise, the decedent would not have done this. And that's what the court found as well. Unless the panel has any other questions, I believe I have hit the points I want to hit.
Either my colleagues have a question.
And then
it does not look like it.
All right. I will conclude by asking this. I believe that the record reflects that the court was very diligent at the time of trial, made very clear findings of fact, and that the respondents met their burden of proof by clear and convincing evidence. And the court did exactly what the court should have done under the probate law in distributing the remaining assets to the other heirs. And I would ask that this court fully affirm the decision of the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Rondoni. And Mr. Worley, you will now have 5 minutes of rebuttal. We'll set the clock for you and then you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. Just wanted to make sure I didn't start talking before the timer. It appears that the respondents admit that they didn't raise the right of retainer argument below. It's very important for us to pay attention to that statute, which is 524.3-903, because it says that any person who this is going to be used against has the benefit of any defense which would be available to a successor in a direct proceeding for the recovery of the debt. So they've admitted that they didn't raise it, and the statute specifically allows my client to defenses. For example, she could have, if it would have been raised, could have submitted evidence as to what it was spent on. And the court might have found that that was okay if it was spent on her mother, for example. So,
Mr. Worley, do you agree, though, that this was a debt to the estate?
I do not. No, Your Honor. I think the record is clear that the decedent intended that these be joint accounts, and that was the evidence all the way back in 2008. The only evidence we have is the account, and there's no other evidence to rebut that.
Well, isn't there evidence to rebut that in her assurances that she would distribute the funds equally after her mother's death? I mean, if the intent was that she get the remains of the account all along, why would she have assured her mother that she would, the court found that she assured her mother that she would distribute the funds. So isn't that inconsistent with the idea that the joint account was in, those funds were intended to pass to her all along?
Well, I would say that would be true if this record were complete. If this issue had been raised and my client knew this was being litigated, she would have submitted contradictory evidence to that which was submitted, but she didn't know, and in fact didn't need to submit evidence to contradict that. And so the record is incomplete. I mean, the findings may point in that direction right now, but that was because these findings were on a different issue. They were on a different lawsuit. And if a lawsuit was going to be brought about these accounts, it should have been brought about these accounts.
Mr. Worley, the district court found that your client received more than her fair share of the estate. What is your best argument that the district court, and the district, I think we all agree that the district court has equity powers in probate. What is your best argument that the district court did not have the authority to order the distribution of the assets in the manner it did?
Equity can only be used to supplement law or statutes and case law. It cannot be used to contradict them and to supplant them. There's very clear case law saying that a district judge, and this is Cosgrave's will, cannot rewrite or remake a will to avoid a result that the district judge feels is undesirable. And then there's this estate of buyer that says the will itself is a conclusive presumption of what the testator wanted, and it conclusively presumes that they've taken into account everything else that they've given. So it's not the district judge, it's not the trial judge's province to decide who was supposed to get what. When someone in Minnesota, all the citizens of the state of Minnesota have the right to determine how their assets are going to pass, and they determine that by making a will.
So Mr. Worley, I was looking at that Cosgrove decision as well, and I understand the part you're citing, but I'm looking at the part where, they're quoting Amsher, but you know, equity may interpose its protective authority whenever it appears that the trustee, no personal representative, is perverting his powers to the detriment, you know, of the trust, and it can assume jurisdiction in the proper case to remove the trustee and use those equitable powers. I mean, why doesn't the very case, a different part of the very case you're citing, say, yes, the district court, even if he didn't, the statute wasn't cited, had the equitable powers to do exactly what he did.
Right. So in Cosgrave's will, the equitable power to remove a trustee, there's nothing in the law that says a district court does not have the power to remove a trustee. And therefore, exercising equitable power in that sense in Cosgrave's will would have been appropriate. In our case, there's a specific case that says a judge can't do what our judge tried to do, which was rewrite or remake a will.
And it, is that, if that's the finish of the question, you certainly, or answer, you may finish it, Mr. Worley, and then you can provide your summary ending if you would.
Yes, that was the end of the question. I timed it. I saw it. Anyways, yes. So thank you, Your Honor. My summary here is this, that the district judge looked at this case and he saw the evidence and he didn't like the way things were going and tried to rewrite the will to fit what he believed was the most equitable result. And that's simply not allowed. And the only justification we've seen for it is a justification that my client was indebted to the estate, but respondents have admitted that my client didn't have notice that the trial was about whether she was indebted to the estate. If she's going to have property rights taken away in that instance, she needs notice. She needs due process. Even if everyone believes what she did was wrong, she needs due process to defend herself, to have depositions, to submit evidence. That's our system. Thank you very much.
And thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions today. Certainly, your case raises some interesting legal issues and phrases in the probate code we don't get to use every day. So we appreciate that. We will issue a ruling and within the 90-day period as required. And you each have a great day.